You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community. And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon. From the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Todd Wicks. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, January 29th, 2019.
And in particular, what we saw is just an end to frostbite as a major issue in a community, that people were getting into safe locations and were not losing their fingers and toes through frostbite.
Later in the program, we'll hear from Reverend Forrest Gilmore about the precautions and efforts the Shalom Community Center and other area homeless shelters provide when temperatures get dangerous for those living out of doors. That's coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Alan Dunn tells the story of his ancestors who set up in Monroe County and eventually forged the Fish Weather Vane on top of the Monroe County Courthouse. Dunn's story is coming up later in the program in this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana. But first, your daily headlines.
Schools across Indiana and much of the Midwest are canceling classes as temperatures drop into dangerous territory. The National Weather Service is warning area residents that just 5 minutes of exposure in below-freezing temperatures can be enough for frostbite and hypothermia to set in. Monroe County government has canceled all meetings and its offices will be closed tomorrow due to negative temperatures. Monroe County Community Schools will also be closed tomorrow. The City of Bloomington's offices will remain open, says Community Director Yale Cassander, although sanitation services to area residents are suspended.
We want to make sure everyone stays safe. The city is anticipating, however, remaining open and operational tomorrow and the next day, barring any unforeseen emergencies. And for folks who need to be absent, who anticipate not being able to make it in, we're asking those employees of the city to arrange with their supervisors to take scheduled or unscheduled PTO time. The roads, as you know, are not expected to be icy or snowy, but that cold is going to be prohibitive, and so we encourage everyone to be as careful and safe and bundle up. And however, those who are working outdoors, including folks who are on the sanitation routes and working for parks, have been given alternate inside work to do, given those extreme cold temperatures.
Lows tonight and tomorrow are expected to be around minus 8 degrees, with a high tomorrow of 2 degrees Fahrenheit. Those temperatures are expected to warm back up next week as temperatures rise again to above freezing. Brown County schools are also closed tomorrow, as is Mother Hubbard's Cupboard and several transportation services both in Monroe and Brown counties.
An Indiana lawmaker's efforts to eliminate the state's child labor laws have raised conflict of interest concerns. The Associated Press reports Republican State Senator Chip Perfect's bill would remove work permit requirements for minors and remove restrictions on hours that 16 and 17-year-olds can work. Senator Perfect is also the owner of Perfect North Slopes, which employs an estimate 300 to 400 miners every winter, according to an Indianapolis Star investigation. Political watchdog group Common Cause Indiana is calling for additional scrutiny of Perfect's bill. The Lawrenceburg, Indiana state senator said his miners' work bill focuses on small businesses and denies any claims of a conflict of interest. The Senate's Ethics Committee doesn't review conflict of interest issues unless a review is requested. Bill's supporters include Matt Eckert, the CEO of Holiday Word Theme Park in Santa Claus, Indiana. Opponents of Perfect's bills say completely eliminating the state's child labor laws isn't the right solution to the system's problems.
The Herald Times of Bloomington is among 8 Indiana newspapers which have been sold to Gatehouse Media. South Bend-based Schertz Communications Incorporated purchased the Herald Times in 1966. Scott Schertz announced the sale of the Bloomington-based newspaper yesterday morning. The former publisher, along with outgoing editor Bob Salzberg, announced the paper, along with other holdings of Schertz Communications Publishing Division, will be sold on Friday. Gatehouse Media, based in New York, will acquire the Herald Times, along with 7 other Indiana newspapers. The Reporter Times in Martinsville, the Moresville Decatur Times, the South Bend Tribune, the Times Mail in Bedford, the Notre Dame Insider in South Bend, the Evening World in Spencer, and the Hoosier Topics are also part of the sale. Salzberg announced his retirement last year. His last day is this week. A source at the Herald Times says layoffs are expected at the paper this week, although declined to characterize how severe those layoffs may be. Hoosier Times newspapers, which includes the Herald Times and publications in Spencer, Bedford, and Martinsville, cut 17 jobs in August of last year. Those cuts were also announced by Schertz Communications, who cited rising newsprint costs and reduced revenues in their decision.
A hike in stormwater fees is proposed by the City of Bloomington Utilities Department, and it could get even higher. Last week, the Bloomington Utilities Service Board approved raising the stormwater fee to $5.95 a month. CBU had already proposed raising the stormwater fee from $2.70 to $5.15 a month. Speaking in the board's Tuesday meeting, Utilities Director Vic Kelson said the increase will fund repairs to failing infrastructure.
So this would be the completion of the Jordan River Tunnel that goes essentially from near 4th and Grant to 1st and Washington. It goes under the 3rd and Lincoln intersection. That's the place where we had to do the temporary repair a couple of years ago, and so forth. So that project plus replacement of an inlet structure at 6th and Indiana and replacement of culvert on Spanker's Ditch that is also in poor condition. Those projects together totaled about $12 million. And the funding those projects would have raised the storm fee to $5.15.
That proposed increase has already been submitted to the Bloomington City Council. But board member Amanda Burnham said Mayor John Hamilton has now suggested that a larger rate increase could fund green infrastructure projects.
Since our last meeting, the mayor has come back and asked that we consider a $5.95 increase, which is 80 cents more than what we originally discussing. And it, again, is to help us consider some of these green infrastructures for stormwater.
Utilities Director Kelson said his department doesn't currently have green infrastructure because it's never been funded before. He discussed a variety of potential projects the city might undertake. For example, a vegetation-filled drainage basin.
So in cross-section, you see the water sits on top. It moves through the soil, which provides some bioretention for to hold the water back. As it's being filtered into the gravel bed, and then it goes out through an under drain. So what will happen now is that solids and organic contaminants can be consumed by the plants and vegetation and by some organisms in the soil before the water moves on. So what would happen in this case is that the water from the neighborhood that falls into this basin would not immediately go to the culvert, but would get there much more slowly and would be pretreated before it goes out.
Kelson also listed rain gardens as potential green projects. He said the benefit of green infrastructure is better water quality downstream with less flooding.
Another benefit also that would come over time is the more we're able to detain the water, and it will tend to reduce the amount of inflow and infiltration to the sanitary sewer, which is water that we now treat. So that would, there is a potential for this program to improve the performance of our sanitary system.
According to Kelson, pushing the rate to $5.95 would generate about $400,000 for green infrastructure. The Bloomington City Council will have to approve the fee increase before it can go into effect, and any new green infrastructure projects would have to be approved by the Utilities Service Board. Board President Julie Roberts voiced her support.
I'm very much in favor of green infrastructure because we've added so much roof and so much pavement that we're to the point where all we're doing is making it flow faster and harder, and we're going to, you know, restore a big storm event, and we're going to have to add basins at the plants because we can't deal with all the water coming in.
CBU raised its sewer and water rates in 2016. If the city council approves a new stormwater rate, Kelson said it could be phased in starting July 1st of this year. He also said CBU customers can expect another small sewer fee increase in 2020 and another water rate increase in 2021.
Residents of East Chicago are pushing back against an EPA proposal aimed at remediating a lead and arsenic contamination site. As WFHB correspondent Dulce Haralo reports, community members are lobbying for full remediation of the site in West Calumet rather than an EPA proposal to partly remove contaminants.
The Environmental Protection Agency evicted around 1,000 people from the West Calumet housing complex because of lead and arsenic contaminated soil. The Superfund site was formerly a U.S. smelting and lead refinery facility. The site includes part of the former USS lead facility. Areas nearby include commercial, municipal, and residential buildings. According to EPA records, the site was originally used as a lead refinery. Surrounding businesses at the time were engaged in similar operations. Residents of the West Calumet housing complex were demolished back in April of last year. The EPA plans a 7-month cleanup of the area. That proposed remediation effort would remove the top 2 feet of contaminated soil and dispose of it at a landfill. The current proposal would rezone the site for industrial commercial use. The proposal would see the site not fully remediated. The Times of Northwest Indiana reports East Chicago Mayor Anthony Copeland said 2 commercial or industrial developers are interested in the space. But area residents say they want the site to be fully remediated. Local groups say they prefer a plan that costs about $50 million instead of the EPA's $26.5 million plan to ensure full cleanup of the area. East Chicago Calumet Advisory Group and Calumet Lives Matter say the EPA's cleanup plan would not address contamination deeper than 2 feet of soil. They also say the limited cleanup plan would also limit residential redevelopment. The EPA recently canceled a January 14th meeting due to the government shutdown. Residents had requested that meeting to air concerns about remediation efforts. With the federal government reopened for the next 3 weeks, it's uncertain whether the agency will reschedule that public input meeting. For WFHB, I'm Dulce Jarillo.
2 Shalom Community Center housing complexes have received renewed grant funding following the reopening of the federal government. The Federal Housing and Urban Development Department announced Shalom's Crawford Homes 1 and 2 have received nearly $1 million in grant services. Crawford 1 and 2 both received over $400,000 in grant allocations from HUD today. The allocations come after the longest federal government shutdown in U.S. history was brought to an end last week. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Todd Wicks. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
Sub-zero temperatures around the listening area and throughout much of the country may create hazardous and dangerous conditions for those exposed to the cold for extended periods of time. Area homeless shelters are extending their hours and services in order to limit the exposure of hundreds of area residents. We hear from Shalom Center Director Forrest Gilmore in today's feature report.
I mean, the biggest concern is that frostbite can occur within just a few minutes with some of these temperatures that we're looking at. So it's really dangerous, and it's not deadly. And so we want to make sure that everyone, especially our most vulnerable members of our community, have a safe place to be and, you know, to pass through the weather and get through the weather. We're doing a couple of different things. One is we're opening up a little bit early, just to kind of, there's some gaps here and there between our sheltering services, and so we're opening earlier at the Shalom Center at 7:30, so that's just giving a little extra time in the morning for people to make their travels from other shelters to us, and then we're extending our Friends Place hours from 5:15 to 4, so that kind of closes that gap over there. And then we're also trying to create as many spaces as we can, extra spaces on couches and on cots and mats and things like that at Friends Place Overnight Shelter so people can come and survive there. We're definitely doing it today and tomorrow to adjust for the cold temperatures. If the temperatures start to change as we're expecting on Thursday, then we'll go back to normal services after that. Our community has, on any given day, probably has somewhere between 340-350 people who are experiencing homelessness here. So that's how many people are out there in the shelters, streets, cars, woods, that kind of thing. Fortunately, at this time of year, most people are not sleeping outside. They're taking advantage of emergency winter sheltering or our regular sheltering. But we're actually doing some active outreach to people who are sleeping outside to try and get them and encourage them to come indoors and get safer. We, Shalom ourselves, we probably see 200 to 300 people a day, you know, about half of whom are experiencing homelessness. Well, most of them come right from Monroe County. Monroe County has a very high poverty rate and also has a very high housing cost or low affordability. So a lot of the homelessness in our community is produced right here at home. The rest of the homelessness is generally coming from the neighboring counties. And almost entirely from Indiana. We don't have great data, but some of the data that we do have tells us that most folks are from here, and the exceptions are from nearby, with almost entirely all of them coming from Indiana. With the advent of the Interfaith Winter Shelter some years ago, we had a dramatic improvement in our situation. In our community, and in particular what we saw is an end to frostbite as a major issue in a community, that people were getting into safe locations and were not losing their fingers and toes through frostbite. So that was a huge advent. We're a really amazing community in that we're able to offer that kind of emergency response in the winter. There was a death some years ago, 5 years ago. The cause of death is not entirely clear, but this young man unfortunately died in a stairwell on one of our colder nights in the middle of the winter. So that was a pretty tragic loss. It's been a partnership that's run from November through the end of March, with the express purpose of trying to get everyone indoors during the winter. It's been it's an interfaith effort that's been organized by many of the churches in our town, and they've just done an amazing job creating a much safer Bloomington during the winter. The center itself is open from 8 to 4 for 7 days a week, and then our overnight shelter Friends Place is open from 5:15 in the evening to about 7:45 in the morning, and that's a sober overnight shelter for people in our community. 40-bed shelter. Our day shelter is low barrier, and so anyone can come to our day shelter during the day. And overnight, there's a low barrier shelter at Wheeler Mission, which is just off of 3rd Street. People take the bus, they walk. We generally don't have we unfortunately don't have the resources to have an active shuttle running, but a lot of people are going to be hunkering down, and we'll make sure that the most vulnerable folks that have trouble with travel, we'll find a way to get them safely to where they need to go. I think the biggest thing I'd want people to know is that if they see somebody out there who's in trouble, is to not ignore it, but to really pay attention to those folks and kind of speak to them or alert the authorities to help those folks get to a safe place. We really want to make sure that everybody who's outside gets inside into a warm, safe place, because this is going to be very dangerous. You know, the the biggest thing in terms of how people can be of real help in the immediate is to, you know, any kind of cold weather gear is really important right now. So hats, gloves, coats, boots, sleeping bags, blankets are all really vital right now. So if people have those to donate, encourage them to do that right away and to bring those into the center at 620 South Walnut Street.
That was Reverend Forrest Gilmore speaking about the extended hours many area service providers will log in order to ensure the safety of those experiencing homelessness in our listening area.
Coming up next, the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana.
Monroe County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County.
Hello, this is my Monroe County story. My name is Alan Dunn. My pioneer forebears were Austin Seward and his wife, Jane Irvin Seward. They were my great-great-great-grandparents who came to Bloomington in 1821. Austin was born in Tidewater, Virginia in 1787 and moved with his family to Madison County, Kentucky when he was six. Upon the death of his father, the family felt hard times and he was apprenticed at age 12 to a blacksmith and then a tool edge maker. After his apprenticeship, he set up shop and became well-regarded for his skills. He was then, at 19, able to marry then 17-year-old Jane Irvin. She was the daughter of Jeanette Brewster Irvin, one of the three colonial Revolutionary War Patriot sisters who emigrated with their husbands to Monroe County from Kentucky to settle, and whose graves can be found in Dunn Cemetery on the IU campus. After visiting and seeing the opportunity in the newly established community, Jane and Austin relocated to Bloomington, where they set up home and shop on the southwest corner of what is now 7th and Walnut. Austin found immediate success as his skills were vital in Monroe County. He was more than a blacksmith. He was also a gunsmith and an edge toolmaker. This meant he could fashion scythes, knives, sickles, shears, augers, etc., but most importantly, he could make steel-edged axes. In the wilderness, which Monroe County was then, an axe was the most important tool a settler could have. And Seward was truly renowned for the quality of tool he could make. As famous as he was for his axes, he was even more renowned as a gunmaker. He constructed the whole weapon, lock, stock, and barrel. Their quality were unsurpassed. As Monroe County grew and his family grew, the business also grew, and his sons and their sons joined him in his work. In the 1840s, the company expanded to do foundry work so they could fashion plows and other cast iron tools. Iron ore came at first from Stanford and then from Owen County, and the power first from men working the bellows, then horses, and then they built their own steam engines to use and sell. They produced implements and tools, but also artistic items like decorative fencing and the cast iron fountain seen in Third Street Park today. Probably Seward's best known claim to fame is his creation of the fish on the courthouse. Made of gilded copper, it was commissioned by the county in the 1840s. It's been atop the courthouses ever since. Austin Seward was active in his community. He founded and led the first Bloomington community band and played in it alongside his sons. He was active in his church and kept a room in his home open and available to traveling clergy. He donated to the needs of the city. Notably, when the state university burned, he gave money to the effort that rebuilt the school and ultimately saved IU from relocation outside of Bloomington. Aside from sending two sons to battle, he and the city contributed to the Civil War effort by taking donated brass from candlesticks, hoop skirts, and the like, melting them down to allow Seward to fashion a 12-pound brass cannon that was tested and sent to battle. The company also manufactured over 50 tons of shot and bombs for the war effort. The business continued to evolve and grow with the community, and Seward's son Williamson B. and grandson William Henry Seward carried on the shop and foundry after Austin's death in 1872. They provided machines, implements, and tools that made it possible for the limestone business and others to flourish. In 1909, both W.B. and W.H. Seward died, and the business was taken over by my grandfather, Fred Allen Seward. He was joined by his younger brother, Austin, as a partner after his service in Battery B in France during World War II. What must be highlighted and never undervalued when relating our family story is the strength and contributions of our mothers and grandmothers. From the pioneer times, when Jane Seward bore and raised 9 children, through to the present, these women were just as active in the community and their church as their husbands, serving in many organizations, as my mother did, for example, on the local Council of Women, when it was charged with owning and operating Bloomington Hospital. In the book, The New Purchase, written in 1843 by Brainerd Hall, who was the original rector of the Indiana Seminary, a chapter is devoted to Austin Seward, where he is given the honorific name Vulcanus Allhart. In it, he's described by the author as, and I quote, "He was a Virginian by birth, by trade a blacksmith, by nature a gentleman, and by grace a Christian."
Join us next week for another edition of the Monroe County Bicentennial Journal.
Support for the Bicentennial Journal and WFHB comes from Monroe County and Visit Bloomington. More information about Monroe County's Bicentennial is available at monroecounty200.us.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Wes Martin and Dulce Gerillo, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
The Bicentennial Journal is produced by Kate Welch with help from Joyce Pauling. Our engineer is Wes Martin. Our theme music was provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Scott Schmedke, and Donnie Graff. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Todd Wicks.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news at WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for Counterspin, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's weekly radio show, providing a critical examination of national headlines. That's coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a daily local news volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at wfhb.org and catch live broadcast of the Daily Local News Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.